Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Amity.
And I'm Laura. Let's get started.
Okay, we are really excited, really thrilled, maybe a little bit anxious to start talking about Anne of Green Gables by Lucy Maud Montgomery. I love it. This is one that has a huge fan base. Lots of people loved it. It's one that I think a lot of people sort of broke their teeth on as far as classics are concerned, especially children's classics. As far as like movie versions of it, I think there's actually a few. I think there's even an animated one, but there's the sort of newer one on Netflix. I think it's called Anne with an E or something. Mm-hmm. That is not super true to the book. There's things about it that I liked, but there's just nothing to me that will replace the one made in the 80s with Megan Follows as Anne. It's one of those that I even hear the theme song and I just start crying because I love it so much. So beautifully done.
It's hard to read the book without seeing the way the characters in that series portrayed what they were saying. Like I can, like Matthew, yeah. I just see him, like his smile, or Marilla, like how she'll like laugh, kind of laugh at Anne, even though she's like irritated with her.
Yes.
It's hard not to see it because we watched it hundreds of times. Yeah. Hundreds. I bet you that's the show I watched the most as a child. I would bet over and over and over.
You think so? Yeah, I do remember watching it a lot. I think that, yeah, it was probably one that we watched over and over too. Because I feel like I have the whole thing memorized.
Well, I can't picture other movies like I do that. Like her clinging to the bridge when the boat sinks, or like at the beginning of, I think, Anne of Avonlea, where she's riding on the beach and the wind comes and picks up her papers and they fly all over and she's like running around trying to pick them up. And everything about that show, I just loved.
Yeah.
Love. Oh,
so much. Every single actor was just wonderful. There was nobody that was awkward. It was just beautifully done. The soundtrack was gorgeous. The acting was wonderful. Yes. The costumes were just spot on. Loved them. The setting, of course.
We should just watch
everything
the movie.
About it. Wait, maybe, you know, we're going to end this episode right here saying, just go watch the movie. That's what you need to do.
But it was also very, very, very close to the book. They did a great job. Like as you're reading through these chapters, it's like almost exactly how they portrayed it in the series.
Yes. And that's another thing. They did such a wonderful job. And that is one thing that I kind of had an issue with in the Anne with an E series is I didn't watch all of it, but the ones that I watched, they totally deviated from the book. And I was like, why? Why did we do that? You didn't need to do that.
Because the book is like perfection.
It's perfection.
Yeah. So you're going to tell us a little bit about Lucy Maud Montgomery, right?
Yes. And there's, I mean, a lot of people have said a lot of things about her. And so there's a lot, but just some brief facts. So she was born on Prince Edward Island in 1874. And she died in Toronto in 1942. She wrote lots and lots and lots of books. And she actually had 3 children. So that's interesting. She published 20 novels and 530 short stories, 500 poems and 30 essays. Anne of Green Gables was an immediate success. Anne Shirley is who made Lucy Maud Montgomery famous. Like we've read some of her other books and they're delightful. She's just a wonderful author. But Anne Shirley is who has carried her into the halls of fame, really, I think, as far as writers are concerned. What else? Well, something that is kind of interesting is that she wrote the first two Anne books. So Anne of Green Gables and then Anne of Avonlea. And then she was like, I don't really want to write anymore about Anne. She says, I've been flooded with letters entreating me to write a third Anne book, but I feel as if I simply could not do it. The freshness has gone out of the Anne idea. It may return someday, but unless it does, I shall never throw any further light on Anne's career. Which is interesting because she actually does go on to write several more and books. So the inspiration must have come, or maybe it was some pressure from all of her fans. I don't know, but she pulled it out and she did really well, I think. Another interesting thing, really quickly, is that Lucy Maud Montgomery was considered to be very, very attractive, very beautiful, and she was constantly being pursued by men. Like, she always had someone knocking down her door, and it sounds like she was engaged a few times. She did finally marry a guy named Ewan McDonald, I want to say, and she had three kids. I think that her relationship was a little bit, it was difficult. Her relationship with her husband was very difficult. He was a reverend. He was a Calvinist who believed in predestination. He often told his wife that he wished she and their children had never been born, as they were also not of the elect. And all of them were going to hell when they died, as he believed that they were all predestined to be among the damned. He did not assist with raising the children or the housework. And he was given over to erratic, reckless driving as if he was deliberately trying to get himself killed in a car crash.
Gosh.
Lucy was driven to depression by her husband's conduct, often writing that she wished she had married somebody else. She wrote in her diary that she could not stand looking at her husband's face. At some point, she moves to England and has her own house or something. I find that really interesting, just because as I was reading Anne this time, her attitude towards men is quite negative, I would say. She doesn't really have a lot of strong male characters. We love Matthew. He's very sweet, but he is not a strong man at all. Most of them are sort of like either total, they're drunk, they're awful, or they're sort of just like cowering in the background. I think that Gilbert himself is probably going to be one of the strongest male characters, but it is kind of interesting to me. And sort of the offhanded comments that she writes throughout there, it's almost like it's her way of getting back at her husband to be like, actually, I think you're trash. But
That'll be an interesting thing to look for through this. It's like her view of men. A lot of the men in her book, at least this book, well, and I've also read, what is that
The
one?
Blue
The
Island?
Island of the Blue,
Or
no, the
the
Blue Castle.
Blue Castle.
Yeah. I don't know
Is
why
the
that
Island of
word.
the Blue Castle?
No, it's just the Blue
No,
Castle.
it's just the Blue Castle. We did Island of the Blue Dolphin. The
Yes.
blue, okay. The Blue Castle.
Yes. And like the men in that book are like really. Bleh. And
Mm-hmm.
so, I mean, if you think about Mrs. Lynde's husband, and like,
Yeah.
that's just kind of all bleh.
Yeah, the strong characters in this are definitely women. Even the ones that you may not
Like,
like as much, they're still very strong.
a lot of girls, young girls, have fallen in love with literature because of this book.
Yes. But it's interesting because at the same time, it is such a wonderful love story that you find yourself like wanting a man like Gilbert at the end of it, you know? And maybe that's what she's trying to do also, is like find yourself a good man, you
And
know?
maybe she's like, I hate men, but hey, I wish I had this kind of a relationship, like
Yeah.
dreaming about this one relationship that,
Yeah,
yeah, I
maybe
just,
so.
oh, Anne, I just love her. One time, I've read this book several times, and I was listening to a podcast about this, the book, and this lady had said she read it like probably 100 times.
Oh, that's
Like,
awesome.
that's crazy. And she said she rereads it like every year, and she rereads through the whole series like all the time. And I'm like, that's
Wow.
crazy. But I mean, I can remember when my husband was in the hospital. Maybe the, f I think it was the first time he was in the hospital for a long time when I was pregnant with Charlie. I was reading it. Either that or the second time. I can't remember because he was in the hospital when I was pregnant with Charlie. Maybe not. Maybe it was the second time when he had heart surgery. And so I had two kids by then, but I remember reading this distinctly sitting in the ICU behind his bed, engrossed in like my happy place of Anne of Green Gables while I wondered if my husband was going to live or die.
But
So,
see, which that was a very Anne thing to do, to
yeah.
be in like kind of an awful situation and making the best of it.
It was like my comfort, you know, just.
Yeah.
So beautiful. And at this time, as I've been reading it, I'm just like, you feel home.
Yeah.
Feel like
Yeah.
you're at home. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyways.
So good.
Okay. So this time, we're gonna, as we've been studying this, we're like, oh, this could go on for hours. So we're gonna try to make our summaries really quick and see how this goes. Because everything is quotable, everything.
It is. And so what we're going to do is we're going to drive you to our Instagram and Facebook pages, because when these start coming out, I'm going to try really hard to do a daily Anne Shirley slash just Anne of Green Gables quote, so that we can get in as much as we can, because it's so, like you say, it is so quotable. There's so many good lines in here, and there's so many times I just found myself just cracking up. It was hilarious.
I know.
But also it's very deep, and there's just a lot to think about. It's also kind of heart-wrenching. So all the emotions, it's good. Chapter one is called Mrs. Rachel Lynde is Surprised. And I kind of love that it starts with Rachel Lynde. Now, as far as setting, we are on Prince Edward Island, which is in Nova Scotia, Canada. And we're in the town of Avonlea. There are several little towns in Avonlea, all on this Prince Edward Island, which is fairly small, I believe. But this little place called Avonlea is just, you just fall in love with it. And also the name, it's just so cute. So we start with Mrs. Rachel, who is a star character throughout all the Anne books. And what we learn about her immediately is that she is a busybody. Nothing can go past her house, but she needs to know why. Why is it going past my house at this time? And so she's sitting in her house and she sees Matthew Cuthbert, who is her neighbor, driving past in a buggy, and he's wearing a collar and a suit, and he's driving slowly, and she needs to know why. So she runs over to the Cuthbert's house to find out why. Now, this is another one of those books where everybody's house has a name, which I love, and they're all so cute. So Rachel Lynde and her husband Thomas live in Lynde Hollow, and her neighbors, the Cuthberts, Marilla and Matthew, who are brother and sister. I always remember being a little bit confused when I was really little watching the movie and going, but they're married. They have the same last name. So what's, I didn't understand that relationship. Then it became clear. But they're brother and sister. They're both old maid, bachelor, never married, no family except each other. And they live on this beautiful piece of land. And their house is called Green Gables, which is adorable. She runs over to Marilla to find out what in the world is going on. Marilla tells her, Matthew has just gone over to Bright River to pick up an orphan that they had sort of ordered. Things were done very differently in those days. To have brought over a little boy, young enough that they could raise him up and teach him, old enough that he could start doing chores immediately to help around the farm, because Matthew is getting older in years. Mrs. Rachel does not approve of this, and she lets Marilla know that. And she tells her, of course, all these horror stories about families who had adopted orphans and they've gotten strychnine in their well and things like that. Marilla is like, nevertheless, we are adopting a boy, and that's what's happening. And of course, Mrs. Rachel is like, well, she's really put out that they didn't come to her and ask her, first of all. And she's like, I actually feel really bad for that orphan, because those two don't know anything about raising a child. Mrs. Rachel herself has had 10 children. So, of course, she is the expert on everything, but especially about children. And so she's going to feel bad for this kid. So, chapter two is called Matthew Cuthbert is Surprised. Matthew had 8 miles to drive to Bright River. And this is not 8 miles in a car, this is 8 miles in a wagon with a mare. So, it does take quite a while. We learn that Matthew is extremely shy. Like, he hates going out in public because he knows he's going to be required to like nod at people and acknowledge their existence. And it makes him so nervous. We find out that he's about 6 years old and he's as sweet as can be, but just painfully shy. So he gets to Bright River, pulls up to the train station, gets out, and the only person there is this little girl. So he goes into the station master and asks if he's missed the train or when the train is expected. Station master says it's already come and gone. That little girl is here waiting for you. And Matthew's like, no, there's no way. We asked for a boy. Station master says, well, then I don't know what to tell you, because she's here for you. He said, Mrs. Spencer came off the train with that girl and gave her into my charge. Said you and your sister were adopting her from an orphan asylum and that you would be along for her presently. That's all I know about it. And I haven't got any more orphans concealed hereabouts. And he says, hey, if you have any questions, go ask her. She has plenty to say.
She has
So,
all the
Matthew,
answers.
she has all the answers. sisters. Exactly. So Matthew works up the courage to go out and talk to her. And he finds out that that is true. There was some mistake at some point, and she has been brought by this Mrs. Spencer to Matthew and Marilla. We get a quick glance of her, which I'll just go over real quick. She was about 11. She was garbed in a very short, very tight, very ugly dress of yellowish gray wincey. She wore a faded brown sailor hat, and beneath the hat, extending down her back, were two braids of very thick, decidedly red hair. Her face was small, white, and thin, also much freckled. Her mouth was large, and so were her eyes that looked green in some lights and moods and gray in others. And she also carries a very shabby, old-fashioned carpet bag. So from there, she kind of wins him over immediately, and he does not have the heart to tell her that there's been a mistake. And he's also like, I also can't just leave this child here. So he's like, I'll let Marilla tell her. So he's like, I'd rather deal with that. So he's like, well, let's get going, you know? And from there, she proceeds to talk his ear off. She has lots to say, and she has an incredible imagination. And one thing that she says is, am I talking too much? And he says, well, I don't mind, you know? She's like, oh, that is such a relief, because I'm forever being told that I talk too much and to hold my tongue. She's like, and I can if I need to, but it is really nice to just let it all out, you know? And Matthew is kind of the perfect companion, because he doesn't have super strong opinions about anything. He doesn't feel the need to talk and chatter. And so they just have this very pleasant ride home, the 8 miles back to Green Gables. She has a lot to say. We can maybe go back and talk about some of those things. But on the way, she names all these places that throughout the book we'll refer back to. So they go through this place called the Avenue. That's just all these apple trees that come together in the middle to sort of form this canopy over this road that goes on for, I think it says 200 or 300 yards or 500, I don't know. And it's called the Avenue. And she's like, no, it needs to be called the White Way of Delight. And then they get into Avonlea, they get closer to their house, and they go past Barry's Pond. And she says, no, it needs to be called the Lake of Shining Waters. And so, anyway, she had the name for everything. It's really funny, and it's really cute. So he kind of like points out things as he goes along, and she, as they go along, if she asks, and she talks his little ear off. But by the end of it, he is completely enchanted, to where he's like, it was not of Marilla or himself he was thinking, or of the trouble this mistake was probably going to make for them, but of the child's disappointment. When he thought of that rapt light being quenched in her eyes, he had an uncomfortable feeling that he was going to assist at murdering someone or something. They're about to go and see Marilla. There it is.
I don't often like books where the narrate or the characters will go on and on and on and on, but she's just so wonderful to listen to. It's just hilarious, like just delightful. One of my favorite parts, I have a couple of parts here that I highlighted, but I think this is my favorite one. So this gives me a question for you. She says, well, so she's talking about her red hair. She tells him, like, I can't be perfectly happy because look at this hair. What color is it? And he's like, well, it was red, isn't it? And anyway, so she goes on and on about she doesn't like red hair, but she says, well, whatever it was, it must have been something nice because, oh, she's talking about her red hair. She says she read about a girl once who had gold rippling hair back from her alabaster brow, and he can't tell her what an alabaster brow is, and nobody has been able to tell her up until now. She keeps asking everybody, and she says, well, whatever it was, it must have been something nice because she was divinely beautiful. Have you ever imagined what it must feel like to be divinely beautiful? And he says, well, no, I haven't. And then she says, I have often. Which would you rather be if you had the choice, divinely beautiful or dazzlingly clever or angelically good? So that's my question for you, because I can't decide which one of those I would want to be.
I love it. It is like such a quandary, and it like again, it's just brilliant writing. And she's like, I don't know what I would choose either.
Which, you'll say that,
We
but
should pick two. Let's pick two. Yes.
so I don't know. I like them all.
I know. I think that I would go with angelically good and the clever. What was the clever one?
Yeah, dazzlingly clever. I think so too.
Dazzlingly clever, because if you have both of those things, it kind of improves your looks, I think, in people's eyes. And there's a lot that you can do about your looks, you know, especially these days. So I think I would go for those two.
I asked Sydney that too today. I asked her that question and she said, "Well, you can always buy looks." I said, "True, but you probably couldn't then. Maybe you could a little bit, but I was like, that's a hard question because you wouldn't want to not be good."
I know. I mean, I guess that's the thing too, is like, are you bad if you don't choose the good?
I know. It's
At the
just
same time, to quote Anne from later on in the book, we don't want to be totally wicked, but we like it if we can. What does she say? She doesn't want a man who is wicked, but she would like it if he could be wicked. So maybe not like so good that, you know, there's like no room for mischief or something. I don't know.
okay, so another thing is David and I have talked about this too, and like we do have experience with somebody in our family that is, what is the word, divinely beautiful. And they get a lot of things because of it. So sometimes we're like, wouldn't that be nice? I just for occasion,
Seriously,
it does help.
see how differently people suddenly treat you. Which, I mean, there's a downside to that because you're like, hey, they're just treating me that way because they think I'm attractive. But
But just
oh
once in
well.
a while, it would be really
Yeah.
nice.
Yeah.
And it is really interesting how different people treat you, because I have been much heavier than I am now, and people treat you totally different. And they will say, like, when you've lost weight, they're like, "You look so good." And it's
Yeah.
like, well, what did I look like before? I mean,
Right. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just funny that they do treat you differently. So.
Yeah.
Okay, and then my other quote I had for this was just the one page before. So these are both in chapter two when she says, "I want to have this attitude in life." She says, "Isn't it splendid to think of all the things there are to find out about? It just makes me feel glad to be alive. It's such an interesting world. It wouldn't be half so interesting if we knew all about everything, would it? There'd be no scope for imagination then, would there?" You just love that.
I love it too. And that's actually something that I had marked. So I'm glad that you went ahead and shared it because what an incredible attitude, you know. And I just think that everybody needs to have that attitude. And when you meet people who are know-it-alls, you're like, you don't know everything and you don't appreciate, because you think you know everything, you don't appreciate how much there is to know and how wonderful that is that we can never know everything. That's a beautiful thing that we can always keep on learning. And I love that she said there'd be no scope for imagination. And I think that's interesting because the people that I know in my life that are know-it-alls, they literally think they're smarter than everybody. They don't have any imagination. It's interesting.
I don't think I have very much imagination. Maybe that's why I like reading about somebody who does.
You
Yeah.
probably have more than you think.
Hopefully. I feel like I don't.
I think that if you allow other people room for error, that is imagination, because it's like I imagine that this is not that they're not permanently this way, that they can make mistakes and that they can get better. I think that's part of imagination too. It's just like allowing error in other people, and yeah, you're just always thinking outside the box a little bit.
Yeah, I think sometimes I always think like I'm not very creative. And then I think, well, I am in a couple of areas just because I'm, we always look at our lack of like, I'm not creative in this area. I can't draw. I can't, make up stories or whatever. But like, I do make music. So that's creative.
That is creative.
So you just kind of look at like where you lack and then think, well, I have no
Yeah.
imagination, but I probably do have an imagination.
You came up with this idea for a podcast. You are a very business-minded person, and I think that that takes incredible creativity and imagination. So,
Anyways, it's just, and I'm so impressed with your posts because like that just boggles my mind. I would sit there for hours and never be able to come up with something. So I'm glad you do that.
thank you.
Chapter three is Marilla Cuthbert is surprised. Now, this is interesting because up till this point, like Anne doesn't know that they don't want her, like that it was a mistake. Matthew hadn't
Yeah.
said anything to her. They get to the door and Marilla is quite vocal about it. Right away, she's like, "Wait a second. We asked for a boy, and why did you bring this child home?" And he's kind of like, what did you want me to do? Like, I couldn't leave her at the train station. Anne's standing there and she's like figuring out what has happened. And then she just bursts into tears, right? She's like, all my dreams are coming true. And then they all come crashing down on her. I mean, Marilla is somebody that we grow to love through the book. But at first she is, you know, her and Anne are just total opposites. 100%. Marilla has zero imagination. And Anne is like the most imaginative person you can imagine, right? So Anne bursts into tears and Marilla's like, there's no need to cry so about it. And she's like, yes, there is a need. You would cry too. That reminds me of the song, You Would Cry Too If It Happened to You. You would cry too if you were an orphan and come to a place you thought was going to be home and found that they didn't want you because you weren't a boy. Oh, this is the most tragical thing that has ever happened to me. I was like, tragical. I had to look up. Is that a word? Yes, it is. But it usually has something to do with death. It's how dramatic.
And she probably saw it that way, though.
Yes. So Marilla's like, okay, you could stay for the night when we investigate what has happened here. So then she asks her, what's your name? And Anne's like, will you please call me Cordelia? She says, call you Cordelia? Is that your name? No, it's not exactly my name, but I would love to be called Cordelia. It's such a perfectly elegant name. Then she tells her like, well, Anne is such an unromantic name, but if I do have to be called Anne, can I be called Anne with an E? Marilla's like, why does it even matter how you spell it? She's like, because when I say it, I think of how it's spelled, and E, Anne with an E is just, it makes so much the difference. She says, it's just so much nicer. She says, when you hear a name pronounced, can't you see it in your mind just if it was printed out? I can. And A-N-N looks dreadful, but A-N-N-E looks so much more distinguished.
Quick question. Yes. Do you see words spelled out in your mind when you say them and names?
I don't know. Maybe. Names, maybe.
I see words and names spelled out in my mind all the time. So I kind of love that she says that because I was like, maybe that's just a thing for everybody. I don't know. If I don't know how to spell something and it will seem wrong in my mind, then I can figure out, I can find out how to spell it and then it will be right.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
This is what I think is funny. If you could just call me Anne with an E, then I can reconcile the fact that I'm not Cordelia. But I'm like, how would you know she's calling you Anne with an E? The same name.
Anyway. As long as she says she is.
Yes. So my question for you is, and I have no imagination, so this was not the case for me, but when you were a child, did you ever wish you had a different name?
Well, yes, because my name is so unusual. I did not like it when people asked me my name because I already knew I'd have to say it like two or three times. As soon as I said it, they'd be like, what? People would mispronounce it. They'd missay it all the time. So I did not love it. And especially as a little girl, it seems like kind of a big name for a little girl. And so I remember imagining the name Tressica. It's like, that is such a pretty name. I totally thought I made it up. And then when I was in high school, there was a girl whose name was Tressica. It was really funny. Anyways. She was beautiful.
That's an interesting name. That's funny.
Sure is.
I just hated my name because it was so old fashioned and I knew no Lauras. There
really?
Were no other kids. There was a girl when I went into middle school, there was one other girl that was named Laura. Hmm. But when I went to college, there were lots of Lauras. So I think it was like a quote unquote Mormon name, maybe, which is funny because my parents didn't go to church when I was born. So it doesn't make any sense. But it's just interesting. Like, it just sounded, it was, to me, it was so old fashioned. I just wanted like a regular modern name. But now as an adult, I'm like, if my name wasn't Laura, I might have named a kid Laura. Like, I love old names.
I love it too. I've always loved the name Laura. Maybe because I just grew up on Laura Ingalls Wilder and it was just like my favorite. And also we were very much into like knowing who our great grandparents were and everything. And my great grandma was Laura and her husband was David, actually. Anyways, my aunt's name was Laurel. Anyway, I don't know. It's just a name that it doesn't seem old fashioned to me. It just has always been relevant. It's always been a very beautiful name to me.
When I was a little kid, I was like, this is the most awful name, but now I like it. So it's fine. Yeah. And not everybody is named Laura. You don't really see that very often.
Yeah, it's like it's very classic, it's very beautiful, but it's not overused.
I had a Cabbage Patch doll that I named like Pauline, and I thought that just sounded like so sophisticated, business-like. That's how I don't know that I wanted my name to be that, but like I love those kind of
yeah,
names. Anyways,
that you thought it was a good name.
Yes. Marilla then asks Anne, like, do you know how this mistake might have happened? Anne says, I'm sure that Mrs. Spencer asked for a girl that was about 11 years old. Like, I was there and I heard her say that. And come to find out, it was like through the grapevine.
Yeah.
Like, it had come from Mr. Spencer to his daughter to, you know, anyway. So it kind of somehow got switched. Maybe the little girl was like, I'd rather have a girl. So let's say a girl. So then she says, it would have been better if she hadn't seen the White Way of Delight and the Lake of Shining Waters. So that night at dinner, like, Anne can barely eat. And this is the part where we get the depths of despair. And she's like, why aren't you eating? And she's like, I'm just in the depths of despair. Have you not ever been in the depths of despair? And Matthew isn't saying much at all. But after they have this, Marilla says, like, she can't even imagine ever being in the depths of despair. Like, things are just the way they are. And this is how things are. And
yeah,
I don't get it. Anyway, so Matthew says then, he hasn't said much, but then he's like, well, Anne's probably getting tired. You should put her to bed. You know, they had prepared a bed for her down by the kitchen, but then they're like, she's a girl. So like, that's not going to work, but I'm not going to put a little orphan in the guest bedroom. So they take her up to the east gable room. Anne walks up there like hanging her head and upset, says spiritlessly. Like, I can imagine how dramatically she's walking up the stairs. She's so dramatic.
All the time.
So, and I love the description of the room when they get up there. It says the whole apartment was of a rigidity not to be described in words, but which sent a shiver to the very marrow of Anne's bones. So this room is like bare bones.
Yes.
Nothing in it.
Very institutional.
Yes. Anne gets ready for bed. Marilla comes back up to get the candle and she kind of awkwardly says goodnight. It says it a couple times like this. She's like, doesn't really know how to talk to little kids. And so she's like, it comes across as cold, but she's just awkward. And that's not what she means. She says goodnight. And Anne's like, how could you call it a good night when you know it must be the very worst night I've ever had? And so then Marilla goes downstairs and Matthew is smoking, which he doesn't normally do because Marilla doesn't like it. But he does it when he's upset about things. So he says to her, she's a real nice little thing. Marilla says, yeah, but she's not going to do us any good. We asked for a boy. This is not going to help us out. And he says, we might be some good to her. And that's when Marilla says, Matthew Cuthbert, I believe this child has bewitched you. I can see as plain that you want to keep her. And then he suggests, well, we could just hire a little French boy to come help me and Anne could stay and be company for you. Of course, Marilla doesn't think that she needs any company and she's determined to not keep her. And then as Matthew goes to bed, Marilla finishes up the dishes and she says, and it says upstairs in the east gable, a lonely, heart-hungry, friendless child cried herself to sleep. So sad.
It is so sad, especially when you think about like your kids, especially your girls when they're 11. And I don't have an 11-year-old, but I do have a 12-year-old, pretty much the same age. And just thinking about them just being so heartbroken and so lonely and sad. And as you get more of her story, it just gets even more kind of tragic. So
I love what the podcast I listened to about this book was funny. It was interesting because it's like, it's so awful in the beginning, but like by the first half of the book, she like has everything.
Yeah.
A friend, like a house. Anyways, it's just kind of interesting how it starts out so awful. And then quickly she'll accumulate the things she needs. But I also love that like Matthew can see that this is a little girl that's never been loved.
Oh,
she's a little girl that nobody's loved. And like, he can see that if she had love, that there's super like potential there. So
yeah, totally.
Okay. So chapter 4 is the next morning. And of course she's like, at first she wakes up and she doesn't know where she's at. And then she remembers this horrible, awful night that she'd had. But then she sees outside the window that there's like this beautiful blooming cherry tree. And she's like, even if I'm not going to get to stay, I'm going to imagine that I am staying because this place is incredible and just beautiful. So from her window, she can see the Lake of Shining Waters and she can kind of, now they're really close to the ocean, right? Cause she says that she can see a glimpse of the sea from her window, which I thought was just amazing. I remember one time David and I went to a hotel They said like this one room where you could get with like a little glimpse of the sea. It was like this teeny tiny window up in the corner. You could kind of see it.
The hotel probably bragged like
You.
ocean overlook or whatever, and it was
You had to be
like
standing on your tiptoes. Like, yeah, it was not.
yep, there's
Like,
the
well, I think that's it over there. But
ocean,
anyways, that's funny. So this is like Green Gables is just the loveliest place she could have ever even dreamed of. So Marilla comes in and tells her it's time to get dressed, and Anne says about the tree. She's like, oh, isn't it wonderful? And Marilla's like, it's a big tree and it blooms great, but you know, it doesn't really give very much fruit and it's kind of wormy and small and no positivity, no imagination. You just love it. One thing that Anne says to Marilla in the morning is, I'm not in the depths of despair this morning. I can never be in the morning. Isn't it a splendid thing that there are mornings? I want to know, do you feel that way about mornings?
Yes, I love morning.
You always feel better in the morning. Like, and I
Yes.
think it has something to do with sleep.
Yeah.
It repairs things in your brain. And they used to think that it just protected your brain from new information. But now they're like, I'm taking a psychology class.
Okay,
Forgive me.
cool.
But like you learn stuff and then you when you sleep, your brain like works on the connections of what you've learned.
That I feel like that makes so much more sense. And so that when you wake up in the morning, you're probably at a place of much more peace because you've been able to process all that information, figure out where it fits. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense
I
to
think
me.
you can go to bed at night feeling like hopeless and like there's
Yeah.
no solution to something. And then you wake up, or like even in the middle of the night, sometimes you wake up and worry about stuff. And
Yeah.
but then, like in the morning, it's like, okay, it's a new
Yeah.
day. I got
And
this.
that is the worst because it's like, I know I need to sleep in order for me to be able to figure out all this stuff that's keeping me awake.
Yes. I need sleep. You
Yeah.
ever have those nights where you're like, you know you have to sleep. Say you need to get up to go to the airport or something, and like you're like, I gotta sleep, I gotta sleep, I gotta sleep. And then you can't sleep because you're so worried about sleeping.
Oh,
So
yeah.
yeah, that's fun.
No, it's awful.
Okay, so Marilla tells Anne to get ready for the day, which she does, and then she comes downstairs and she continues her lecture about the morning. She says, the world doesn't seem such a howling wilderness as it did last night. I'm so glad it's a sunshiny morning, but I like rainy mornings real well too. All sorts of mornings are interesting, don't you think? You don't know what's going to happen through the day, and there's so much scope for imagination. But I'm glad it's not rainy today because it's easier to be cheerful and bear up under. It's all very well to read about sorrows and imagine yourself living through them heroically, but it's not so nice when you really come to have them, is it? She just goes from like one thing to another. She's like, mornings. And then she's like, okay, it's really great when you can picture bad things happening to you and you know how you'll handle them. But then when they actually happen to you, it's awful.
Yeah.
And I agree.
Yeah. And I think that that is why we enjoy reading her long monologues and why Matthew and Marilla keep saying she has a lot to say, but she's actually really interesting because she has such deep thoughts and she puts these little anecdotes out there and they're like making me think. Yeah, so she is interesting to listen to because she makes them think. And she is engaged with them. She's not just like talking about herself the whole time. She's talking about lots of things that are very relevant and interesting to lots of people, so.
So then Marilla just told her, you need to hold your tongue. You talk too much. So Anne goes silent, which then makes Marilla even more nervous because Anne being silent is so unnatural. She's like, I can't handle this. So they eat in silence. Then this starts making Marilla think about Matthew wanting to keep Anne because they're eating in silence and she's stewing about that. And then she says, I think the narrator says this. That was Matthew's way. Take a whim into his head and cling to it with most amazing silent persistency, a persistency 10 times more potent and effectual in its very silence than if he had talked it out. And I think that's true. Like a lot of times, silent people get a lot more out of you through their silence. And like when they'll talk it out, it's almost easier than when they're just like kind of like passive aggressive. Like
Yeah.
he's like, I'm keeping her. And anyway, so this the silence from him makes her nervous. So after breakfast, then Anne offers to do the dishes, and Marilla's like, are you going to be able to do them right? I mean, she's just so, so harsh and so rigid. And then that's when Anne says, well, I'm a lot better at watching children than doing dishes. And Marilla's like, I don't feel as if I wanted any more children than I have to look after right now. Which is funny because in these other situations, she's watching the kids. And here, she's looked at as a child that needs to be watched after, looked after. Yeah. So anyways, interesting. You know, she's stewing about Matthew. And then she says to Anne, Matthew is a most ridiculous man. Like out of nowhere, because she's been stewing about him in her own head. And then that's when Anne says that her and Matthew seem like kindred spirits. And that's the first time that that phrase comes up. And she's, Marilla's like, well, you're both queer enough. And if that's what you mean by kindred spirits, then okay. So Anne washes the dishes and then she goes up to make her bed, which she struggles with because she'd never made that kind of a bed before. Then they have like a conversation about the geraniums and like she wants to give it a name. I mean, Marilla just has no concept of any kind of imagination. She's like, why would I give it a name? Like it's a geranium. It's a what? Apple spice geranium. This was interesting. Anne says, oh, I like things to have handles, even if they are only geraniums. Handles?
Like I know. Instagram? Yeah, I know. I thought of that too. And I was like, oh, this is actually has been a thing for a while that another name for name is handle.
I looked it up and it came, they started using it in the 1870s. And it was kind of like Mr. and Mrs. Those would, that would be your handle.
Okay.
Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
But it came, I was like, handles? And maybe 10 years ago when I read this, I would never, I mean, obviously there was no Instagram.
Wouldn't have made the connection. Years ago. Yeah, absolutely. Or thought anything of it.
So it was interesting. So she wants to name the geranium Bonnie and she names the cherry tree Snow Queen. And then Marilla goes down to the cellar muttering to herself. I never in all my life saw or heard anything equal to her. She's kind of interesting. As Matthew says, I can feel already that I'm wondering what on earth she'll say next. She'll be casting a spell over me too. She cast it over Matthew. And so then at the end of the chapter, Marilla and Anne are heading off to Mrs. Spencer's to straighten this out. And I love that as they're leaving, Matthew says, little Jerry, I don't know, Buote from the creek was here this morning. And I told him, I guessed I'd hire him for the summer. And Marilla like gets mad and just like rushes off with the buggy. I don't know. She's like, she doesn't even respond to him. She just takes off. She probably rolls her eyes at him like, ugh.
I know. And I think it's so funny that he just kind of feels he's like, he's such a shy person who never has strong preferences at all. But he needed to get that in there. He needed to be like, we can have that covered. I don't need a little boy if I can hire little Jerry.
He's just giving her these little like, I don't know. He's like not having long conversations with her. He's like, I can hire this boy. I told him I'd probably hire him. Like, hint, hint.
Exactly. You'll know what I mean. So chapter 5 is called Anne's History. And this is kind of fun because we find out where she comes from. And so, of course, Anne and Marilla are on their way to Mrs. Spencer's. And Mrs. Spencer lives in White Sands. It's a few miles away. They're going a different route than the way that Matthew went to Bright River to get Anne. This is in a different direction. Still on Prince Edward Island. And something that I thought about was just how interesting it is that even though there's several different towns, everybody kind of knows everybody. I think just because it is small enough, they all kind of have to rely on each other. And it makes me think of like where my husband grew up in Nevada in little tiny town, but he and his parents knew everybody, still know everybody. You know, they know different family names in like all the towns surrounding that. Even if they were like 20, 40, 50 miles away, it's like everybody kind of knew each other. Sort of interesting. And it's the same case here. And first of all, I love this. I'm just going to bring it up real quick. She's like, I'm determined to enjoy this trip. But she does say her life is a perfect graveyard of buried hopes. She says, that's a sentence I read in a book once. And I say it over to comfort myself whenever I'm disappointed in anything. Because whenever you make something more beautiful, it seems to make it better. My life is a perfect graveyard of buried hopes. So tragical, as she would say. So Marilla is like, you may as well tell me about yourself a little bit. And so Anne is like, well, can I tell you what I imagine about myself? And Marilla says, no, just tell me about you. So she says that she was born in Bolingbroke, Nova Scotia. Her father's name was Walter Shirley. He was a high school teacher. Her mother was Bertha Shirley. They were both high school teachers. When they got married, her mother stayed at home. She did not teach anymore. And she says, a husband was enough responsibility, which is really funny. And again, I do think that that is kind of a little poke at the fact that that Lucy Maud Montgomery herself kind of struggled with her relationships. So they were extremely poor. They had this sweet little baby, Mrs. Thomas. We're going to find out more about who Mrs. Thomas is in a little bit. Mrs. Thomas told Anne that she was the homeliest baby she'd ever seen, but that her mother thought she was just perfect and beautiful. And she's like, well, that's what I'm going with, because doesn't a mother know more than the scrub lady? So my mother thought I was beautiful, and that's enough. By the time she was 3 months old, her parents had both passed away from the fever. And I don't know which kind of fever. Was it scarlet fever, or was it pneumonia? I mean, I don't know. But they passed away, and everybody's like, hey, here's this orphan child. Everybody knew that they didn't have any family to speak of. And so Mrs. Thomas takes her on, which is like, that's a good thing. But she really kept her and raised her so that she could be sort of the hired girl in a way. She lived with Mr. and Mrs. Thomas, and it sounds like Mrs. Thomas was the cleaning lady for Anne's parents. Anyway, so she lived with Mr. and Mrs. Thomas for about 8 years until they moved away. Mr. Thomas was a drunk. He was not a nice man, but Anne had helped look after their children. When they moved away from Bolingbroke, they did not want to take Anne with them. The reason that they didn't want to take her is because actually Mr. Thomas was killed by a train. Mrs. Thomas's mother had said, you and the children come live with me, but we're not taking Anne, you know, which that's another thing. I'm like, they raised her since she was a baby, and you wouldn't take her as part of the family, but it was probably better off for Anne anyway. So instead, she went to live with Mrs. Hammond. Mrs. Hammond had eight children. Mr. Hammond worked at a sawmill. She had eight children, six of whom were twins. So she had three sets of twins. And Anne was really there as an 8-year-old to help take care of the babies. Mr. Hammond also died. And this was really interesting and sad, but I know that it happened a lot. Mrs. Hammond broke up housekeeping. She divided her children among her relatives and went to the States. And so at that point is when Anne went to Hopeton, because nobody would take her. And that's where the orphan asylum was. And she'd been there for 4 months when Spencer came. Marilla asks her about her education. She's like, I don't know how she could possibly be educated at all. But she had learned to read, and she could read pretty well. Evidently, she had caught on pretty quickly. But one thing that Marilla asks her is, were those women, were they good to you, Mrs. Thomas and Mrs. Hammond? And Anne just says, well, they meant to be good to me. You know, they were pretty stressed. They had hard lives, but I'm pretty sure they meant to be good to me, which also just breaks your heart because you know that they weren't. But here's a sweet little girl who is so vulnerable, and she's going, well, I think they were trying. And so this gives Marilla a lot of pause and a lot to think about. And something that she thinks to herself is like, she says, what a starved, unloved life this little girl has had. But she's like, I think that her folks were good people. She's very ladylike. And, you know, she has a lot to say, but all the things that she says are not crass. They're not vulgar. They're not rude. She just has a lot to say. She has a lot going on in her. They come to the end of their trip. They come to the Spencers. And so this is where chapter 6 begins, where Marilla makes up her mind. So they go in to see Mrs. Spencer, and Marilla's like, okay, we had specifically asked for a boy. Mrs. Spencer is just so shocked. She's like, no, like I was specifically told a girl about 11 years old. And that's when we find out the whole grapevine that everything went through. And so you could see how it'd get mixed up and everything. And Marilla's like, no, it's our fault. Like, we should have delivered the message ourselves for something like this. But she's like, how can we send her back? You know, Mrs. Spencer's like, I don't think you're going to need to send her back because I was just talking to Mrs. Blewett this morning. And, you know, she has her hands full with all of her children. And she was thinking that she needs a girl to come help her with all of her children. Now, Anne is just kind of horrified, because that's the life that she has just very recently left. She doesn't want to go back to it. She doesn't want to go back to being a little girl that's just there to take care of the children, you know? Marilla is also like, I don't know about that, because Mrs. Blewett, she knows Mrs. Blewett, and she's quite the disciplinarian. She's not really a nice lady. She actually shows up right then, and she is very harsh. She shows her colors right away. She says, "How old are you? What's your name? You don't look as if there was much to you, but you're wiry. I don't know, but the wiry ones are the best after all. Well, if I take you, you'll have to be a good girl, you know, good and smart and respectful. I'll expect you to earn your keep, no mistake about that. I suppose I might as well take her off your hands, Miss Cuthbert. The baby's awful fractious, and I'm clean worn out attending to him. If you like, I can take her home right now." Just kind of a strange thing for a mother to say, to be like, "I'm tired of taking care of my baby, so I'm going to have this girl come do it." But whatever. So it's in that moment that Marilla, as the chapter says, makes up her mind and is like, I just wanted to find out where the mistake was. I never said that we were actually going to send her back. So I'm going to go talk to Matthew, and Anne's going to come with me because she cannot fathom the idea of just leaving Anne with Mrs. Blewett. And you can imagine that Anne is just in absolute disbelief. So they go home and talk to Matthew, and
Is this a chapter where he says, I wouldn't leave a dog I liked with that woman?
yeah, because Marilla tells him, she like kind of gives
Yeah.
him the breakdown of what happened, and he's like, "Yeah, I wouldn't give a dog I didn't like." Or sorry, no, he says, "I wouldn't give a dog I liked to that blue woman." I think it'd be more to the point if he said, "I wouldn't give a dog I didn't like to that blue
Yeah.
woman." So he says, "She's such an interesting little thing," talking about Anne, and Marilla says, "It'd be more to the point if you could say she was a useful little thing." But she's like, "Listen, if we keep her, you need to let me do my thing. You need to let me be the one that raises her, basically." And Matthew just says, "Only be as good and kind to her as you can be without spoiling her. I kind of think she's one of the sort you can do anything with if you only get her to love you."
I highlighted that too. I love that. I think you could do anything with her if you can just get her to love you. That is just so sweet.
Yeah, it is so sweet.
So, a couple of questions I have. So, in the beginning of chapter five, it says, I read in a book once that a rose by any other name would smell as sweet, but I've never been able to believe it. I don't believe a rose would be as nice if it was called a thistle or a skunk cabbage. So, apparently, that's a reference to Shakespeare.
It is. It's Romeo and Juliet.
Yes. And I thought that was kind of cool. And I was wondering that too. Like, do you think there's like a whole theory about that? Like, would something be as sweet if it was called something different? Would it?
I don't know. I mean, the thing is that there are some plants with, and of course, I can't think of them off the top of my head, but I just remember learning the names of some plants and going, "That is an awful name, but it smells really good." Would it be something that we were inclined to make very popular if it had a horrible name? Would it still smell the same and look the same? Probably. But like, I gave a bouquet of skunk cabbage to the person I care about. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Decorate the whole hall with skunk cabbage.
Is funny. So I love the song Jolene by Dolly Parton. Or,
Dolly
yeah.
Parton.
Love that song. And so when I was pregnant with Presley, I brought up, like, what if we named her Jolene? It's like a really bad name. Like, I mean, if anybody's named Jolene, I'm sorry. I just had that thought, like, it could be super cool. Because it's totally different and she'd be named after this cool song. But like, could I do that to her? The other day I'm driving down the road and this I played the song and I said, oh, Presley, I was thinking about naming you Jolene. And she goes, that is a horrible name. I was like, I'm glad we didn't do that.
Well,
But
I will say Ken's cousin married a girl, she's about my age, named Jolene, and she is just lovely, and it totally works for her.
so
But
my
it's
point
hard.
is though
Yes.
is like the child, I mean, does the child become the name or does the name become the child, right? So like if they're a lovely person then the name is like, I don't know, just lovely.
Then the name is good. No, it's, I think it's really true, because especially as you're trying to like name your kids, as you were, there are some names that just immediately get crossed off the list because either you or your partner knows somebody who just ruined the name.
Anyways, so
So,
I wasn't brave enough to name her Jolene, but I was close. And she apparently would have hated it.
oh,
Hopefully not enough people listened to
now
us.
you
They would have the name Jolene, but I love it. And I thought it would be really cool. So, but
Yeah.
a 7-year-old was like, no. So my next thing I just love, this is just the last thing, is that when Mrs. Peter is coming up the lane, she's standing with Mrs. Spencer. And I love this sentence. She's coming up the lane just this minute. You know, it says, where a deadly chill struck on them as if the air had been strained so long through dark green, closely drawn blinds that it had lost every particle of warmth it had ever possessed.
What a sentence.
Like, she sucked the air out of the room.
Yeah.
This dark presence came over us. Like, I just love that.
All the warmth, all the light, it was gone.
And Marilla's like, I cannot send her with. So chapter 7, Anne says her prayers. I love these next two chapters because they're both kind of about prayers and God. Mm-hmm. And this is some very interesting thought provoking things in here. So it's the second night that Anne is there. And so Marilla tells her she needs to say her prayers, to which Anne responds, I don't ever pray. And Marilla's like horrified. And she says, do you even know who God is? So Anne gives her this like dictionary definition of God. God is spirit, infinite, eternal, unchangeable. In his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. And Marilla is relieved that at least she knows something. But she's like, Anne's like, I just love those beautiful, elegant words. It's like poetry. And Marilla's like, you're a very bad little girl for not saying your prayers. Oh boy. I mean, it makes me laugh because nowadays, I mean, we take these parenting classes and you're like, you never tell them they're a bad little girl. Like, this is the opposite of what we know to do now.
Yeah. No labels.
So Anne says, well, you'd find it easier to be bad than good if you had red hair. People who don't have red hair don't know what trouble is. This is like the worst thing she can imagine for anybody is that she has red hair. She says, Mrs. Thomas told me that God made my red hair on purpose, and I've never cared about him since. And anyhow, I'd always be too tired at night to bother saying prayers. She says, people who have to look after twins can't be expected to say prayers, right? So Marilla decides, like, it's time that Anne gets some religious training right now. So Anne gives this big, long explanation of how if she was going to pray, this is what she's going to do. She's going to go out in nature. She's going to look at the sky. She's going to feel the prayer. And Marilla, before this moment, had intended to teach her, now I lay me down to sleep. She's like, I love this sentence about her. This is about Marilla before she says what she's going to say. But it says, the narrator says, but she had, as I have told you, the glimmerings of a sense of humor. So there's like a glimpse of something in Marilla that's going to come out, which is simply another name for a sense of the fitness of things. And it suddenly occurred to her that that simple little prayer, sacred to a white-robed childhood lisping at motherly knees, was entirely unsuited to this freckled witch of a girl who knew and cared nothing about God's love, since she had never had it translated to her through the medium of human love. Beautiful. She just has this moment where she's like, wait a second, I'm way ahead of myself here. Like, this girl's never felt love. How can she ever know God's love and be able to, I don't know, I just...
Yeah.
Amazing moment.
Yeah. And I think that probably the prayer that she was going to teach her, now I lay me down to sleep, seemed very pretentious in this sort of context.
Yeah.
And she really would just be saying words that would mean nothing to her.
Okay. So then she says her own prayer, thanking Heavenly Father for the Lake of Shining Waters, the Snow Queen, Bonnie. And then she ends with the two things that she wants. One is to stay at Green Gables, and two is to be good looking when she grows up.
Fair enough.
And I swear in the movie, Marilla rolls her eyes at this. She just kind of laughs. And she ends the prayer with, yours respectfully, Anne Shirley. Then Anne like asks Marilla, did I do all right? I love this too. Poor Marilla was only preserved from complete collapse by remembering that it was not irreverence, but simply spiritual ignorance on the part of Anne that was responsible for this extraordinary petition. So she tucks Anne into bed and heads downstairs where she says to Matthew Cuthbert, it's about time somebody adopted that child and taught her something. She's next door to a perfect heathen. So chapter 8 goes into more of this spiritual or religious whatever. And I think this is the chapter that's extremely thought provoking. So Marilla has been waiting to tell Anne that they're going to keep her. She just kind of keeps her like busy with doing all these little tasks all day. Yeah. And it's driving Anne crazy. She's like, tell me what's going to happen to me here. So when she finally does say she'll keep her as long as she can be a good little girl, then Anne starts crying and she's like, doesn't understand why she's crying. She's like, why am I crying? Then she just kind of jumps into like, well, Marilla, what should I call you? So she's super excited that she's going to get to stay. And she wants to call Marilla Aunt Marilla, but Marilla says, no, because I'm not your aunt. Like, that's just not the reality of things. And we're not going there. And then this leads to the discussion of imagination. And Marilla never imagines anything, to which Anne says, oh, how much you miss. Then Marilla says, I don't believe in imagining things different from what they really are. When the Lord puts us in certain circumstances, he doesn't mean for us to imagine them away. So Marilla then tells Anne that she's going to spend the rest of the afternoon learning the Lord's Prayer. And so Anne goes into this long lecture about imagining a beautiful prayer last night and not being able to remember a single word of it this morning. Marilla tells her, you need to do what I say, like right away, without all of these long, elaborate speeches that you give me. Like, when I tell you to do something, just go do it. And I've had this conversation with my children all the time. Like, when I say to do something, just go do it, please. So she goes into the other room and she never comes back. And then when Marilla finally goes to look for her, she gets another one of her long speeches. She's been looking at a picture on the wall that's called Christ Blessing Little Children. And this is what she says about it. I was just imagining I was one of them, that I was the little girl in the blue dress standing off by herself in the corner as if she didn't belong to anybody like me. She looks lonely and sad, don't you think? I guess she hadn't any father or mother of her own, but she wanted to be blessed too. So she just crept shyly up on the outside of the crowd, hoping nobody would notice her except him. I'm sure I know just how she felt. Her heart must have beat and her hands must have got cold like mine did when I asked you if I could stay. She was afraid he might notice her, but it's likely he did, don't you think? I've been trying to imagine it all out, her edging a little nearer all the time until she was quite close to him. And then he would look at her and put his hand on her hair and, oh, such a thrill of joy as would run over her. But I wish the artist hadn't painted him so sorrowful looking. All his pictures are like that, if you've noticed. And I don't believe he could really have looked so sad, or the children would have been afraid of him. And then Marilla says, Anne, you shouldn't talk that way. It's irreverent, positively irreverent. And then she says, Anne says, why, I felt just as reverent as could be. I'm sure I didn't mean to be irreverent. And I'm like, Marilla totally misunderstands. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say spirituality, but like Anne was connecting with something.
Yes. There. Yes.
And it's beautiful. And Marilla just can't even, I don't know. It's like, how often do we think like that? Judge somebody, say they say a prayer differently than we would ordinarily hear a prayer said. And there, the person that's saying the prayer is actually having a personal connection, and we're totally missing it.
Yes. Because we can't see the forest for the trees, right? We're not seeing the bigger picture. And like what she chose to focus on was that Anne was critical of how Jesus was depicted, which, to be fair, if she felt like Anne was being irreverent for saying that he shouldn't look sorrowful, well, why is the artist the one whose opinion we're going with? Maybe he's irreverent for saying, for deciding that Jesus was sorrowful looking, but she couldn't really think past that. And we're all so guilty of this all the time, where we can't see the forest for the trees. We get caught up in these little details that don't matter, instead of taking a step back and going, what is really happening here? What is the most important thing? And it's hard to know what's the most important thing sometimes, but in this case, it would seem like it's obvious.
Making a personal connection, I think, is the spiritual, or the reverent way.
Yeah, absolutely.
She was absolutely being reverent, standing there pondering and thinking.
Oh, yeah.
Imagining.
How many times had Marilla done that, you know? How many times does anybody do that?
Marilla probably never had made a personal connection. Yeah. She's just like, this is how we do things. This is how we memorize things. This is what we do.
Right.
Without actually making a connection. It's beautiful. So then we just go into this conversation about the friend down the street, or the girl that Anne is hoping to be her bosom friend, who is Diana Barry, who lives down the street. And Marilla, every time she talks to Anne, she gives a moral. Anne's like, does she have red hair? I hope she doesn't have red hair because there's nothing better than, you know, if I didn't have red hair, I don't want my friends to have red hair. And she says she is good and smart, which is better than being pretty. So there's a little moral that she gives. And then Anne just kind of talks about like her other bosom friends, which were also imaginary friends, Katie Maurice, who'd lived in the bookcase at Mrs. Thomas's house, and then Violetta, who had like been in the echo of the valley when she lived with the Hammonds. But Anne just keeps talking and talking until Marilla finally sends her up to her room and says, like, as long as I'm here listening, you're just going to keep talking. So just go upstairs and learn your prayer. She learns it, oops, all the way up the stairs, and she finishes memorizing the prayer. So when she gets up there, then she goes upstairs. She tries to imagine these beautiful things into the room that she's staying in. And she tries to imagine that her name is Lady Cordelia, but she can't. She holds up a mirror and she says, you're only Anne of Green Gables, but it's a million times nicer to be Anne of Green Gables than Anne of nowhere in particular, isn't it?
There it is. There we get the name of the book.
Yes. And like, isn't it? She is Anne of somewhere now.
Yes, she has belonging.
Love it.
I just wanted to talk really quickly about when Marilla says, you know, Anne is like, oh, you don't imagine things differently. How much you miss, you know, and Marilla, again, she's always trying to teach some sort of moral, not realizing that a lot of times she's incorrect. But she says, when the Lord puts us in certain circumstances, he doesn't mean for us to imagine them away. So, what do you think about that? Does God mean for us to wallow in our miserable circumstances? Or maybe what she's meaning is we need to face our trials and move through them. I don't know.
I mean, I think he
When the
wants
Lord.
us to work to fix our circumstances as best we can. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't think we
Yeah,
should
and
lay down and be like, oh, this is how it is.
yeah, because I guess that's my thought is like, and I feel like Anne is a beautiful example of this because in every situation, she's finding ways to make it better. It doesn't take her trial away. She still has to move through it, you know, but it's still, she's choosing to find a way to make it more pleasant. And that helps her to move through it probably more quickly and with more grace. Because I think that that's what gives us hope. You know, God doesn't mean for us to stay in our trial forever and ever and just kind of wallow in grief. And like you say, just lay down. But he does want us to have hope and to keep moving forward. And so, in that way, I think that for Anne, that's what her imagination does. It gives her constant hope, even in the very difficult circumstances that she has found herself in up to this point, which have lasted for 11 years. Nothing has gone away quickly.
I don't see the downside of imagining or trying to make yourself feel better about things or wish things were different at
Yeah.
all.
Maybe there's some situations where it could lead to like coveting or jealousy or something like that. But if you're like wishing that you were living somebody else's life, but if you're just looking at it going, this is how I see my life getting better and how I see myself getting through this.
Well, and Anne is constantly like appreciating everything that God's given her,
Yeah.
like all the beauty that he's created. So, which one of them is right? I mean, I think Anne's right more than Marilla is most of the
Yeah,
time.
I think so too. And I think that Marilla's lack of imagination has led her to some of these conclusions that I just don't agree with.
Well,
So
yeah, this is how God made it. So, you're just going to have to sit here and handle
deal with it. Yeah.
it. What's funny though is at one point, it might be in the chapters coming up when Marilla, I think it is, it's in your chapters that you're about to do, but Marilla's like, well, my life has been easy so far, but not anymore. I've had a pretty easy life until now, but things are about to get interesting.
I think she says that it's actually the end of chapter 7.
Oh,
She says,
it's
I
right there.
foresee that I shall have my hands full. Well, we can't get through this world without our share of trouble. I've had a pretty easy life of it so far, but my time has come at last, and I suppose I'll just have to make the best of it. So she actually does believe that imagination does help. Because I
Yeah.
don't know that you can make the best of something unless you do have imagination. Chapter 9, Mrs. Rachel Lynde is properly horrified. This is just epic. So it's been 2 weeks and Anne has been at Green Gables. Rachel's and Mrs. Rachel has never come over to say hi because she has gotten dreadfully sick. She has no patience with other people who get sick, but she's determined that when she gets sick, it's really serious. So she's stayed away for 2 weeks. So she makes her way over to Green Gables and is outside doing some other things. So she sits down and chats with Marilla, and then Marilla brings Anne in. And as soon as Anne comes in, Rachel just starts into her. She says, "Well, they didn't pick you for your looks, that's sure and certain. She's terribly skinny and homely, Marilla. Come here, child, and let me have a look at you. Lawful heart, did anyone ever see such freckles and hair as red as carrots?" Anne came there, but not exactly as Mrs. Rachel expected. With one bound, she crossed the kitchen floor and stood before Mrs. Rachel, her face scarlet with anger, her lips quivering, and her whole slender form trembling from head to foot. "I hate you. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you." And she's stamping her foot while she says this. "How dare you call me skinny and ugly? How dare you say I'm freckled and redheaded? You are a rude, impolite, unfeeling woman. How dare you say such things to me? How would you like to have such things said about you? How would you like to be told that you are fat and clumsy and probably hadn't a spark of imagination in you? I don't care if I do hurt your feelings by saying so. I hope I hurt them. You have hurt mine worse than they were ever hurt before, even by Mrs. Thomas's intoxicated husband, and I'll never forgive you for it. Never, never." So there it is. The big explosion. Marilla tells her to go to her room. She does. And Rachel is like, "Well, I feel sorry for you. I don't think you can change that girl." And Marilla surprises herself a little bit by kind of standing up for Anne. She's like, "You shouldn't have said anything about her looks. Like, nobody has taught her any better. She can't help how she looks. And you like bugged her about that." Like, and Rachel's like, "Well, I can see that I'll have to be very careful about what I say from now on, you know?" Like, good grief, woman. Grow up. And then she's leaving and she says, "Marilla, you should come visit me, but I'm not going to come back here for a long time," basically. So Marilla goes and talks to Anne and she's like, "You know that that was really wrong, right? Like, that was pretty awful." And she's like, "You yourself are always talking about your looks and how much you hate them." And Anne says, which is true, "It's one thing for me to say it, but we always have this glimmer of hope that maybe others don't see that. And so when somebody says it to your face, it's like, oh my gosh, it's awful, because that's how people actually do see me. And that's just kind of devastating." And Marilla's like, "Okay, well, the problem is Rachel is going to be telling everybody about this. She's going to spread it all over town." And here's something interesting. Anne says, "Just imagine how you would feel if somebody told you to your face that you were skinny and ugly." And Marilla remembers that she was a very small child and one of her aunts was saying to another, "What a pity, she is such a dark, homely little thing." Marilla has this little, she has a wound, and it's also a connection that she now has with Anne because she remembers this time. So Anne sparks that in her. And so there's not just sympathy, but there's empathy. She remembers how awful it made her feel.
Yeah, I love it how it says Marilla was every day of 50 years before the sting had gone out of that memory.
Yeah, absolutely. It's rough.
When Mrs. Rachel swept out and away, and then it says, "If a fat woman who always waddled could be said to sweep away." Waddling out.
Waddling. Yeah.
Things that wouldn't be written in books today.
That's really true. But it's so rich. It's so good. Marilla is like trying to think of a punishment for Anne, and it suddenly comes to her in this moment, and she's like, "You need to go apologize to her." And Anne says, "I can't, because I'm not sorry." She's like, "I would say it again because I believe it's true. And I cannot ask Mrs. Lynde to forgive me." She does say, "I'm sorry that I've upset you, but I'm not sorry for what I said to Mrs. Lynde." And so Marilla leaves Anne in her room and she's basically like, "You can't come down until you're ready to go and apologize to Mrs. Lynde." But as she's going down, she says she was as angry with herself as with Anne, because whenever she recalled Mrs. Rachel's dumbfounded countenance, her lips twitched with amusement and she felt the most reprehensible desire to laugh, because it was actually kind of funny and fun to see Mrs. Rachel finally get hers. She finally tells Matthew about it. This is chapter 10, Anne's apology. So Marilla finally tells Matthew about it and he's like, "Well, it's about time somebody called her out, you know?" And Marilla's like, "What?" You know, she's kind of appalled. Well, Matthew goes and talks to Anne because she's now been in her room for like a full day. Marilla takes her meals up to her, but she has to stay in her room. And Matthew is like, can you just go apologize to her? Just apologize. You don't really even have to mean it. Just say it so you can get out of your room, basically, because I miss you. We miss you. We need you down there. And that really strikes home for Anne. And so she's like, all right, I can do that. And so she walks over with Marilla. And as they start walking, she seems very lowly and dejected. Did but then halfway there, it's like she just perks up and is almost regal. And Marilla's like, what is going on? Well, she's thinking up her apology. So they get to the Lynn's house. She falls on her knees before Rachel. And this is what she says. Oh, Mrs. Lynn, I'm so extremely sorry, she said with a quiver in her voice. I could never express all my sorrow. No, not if I used up a whole dictionary. You must just imagine it. I behaved terribly to you, and I've disgraced the dear friends, Matthew and Marilla, who have let me stay at Green Gables, although I'm not a boy. I'm a dreadfully wicked and ungrateful girl, and I deserve to be punished and cast out by respectable people forever. It was very wicked of me to fly into a temper because you told me the truth. It was the truth. Every word you said was true. My hair is red, and I'm freckled and skinny and ugly. What I said to you was true, too, but I shouldn't have said it. Oh, Mrs. Lynn, please, please forgive me. If you refuse, it will be a lifelong sorrow to me. You wouldn't like to inflict a lifelong sorrow on a poor little orphan girl, would you? Even if she had a dreadful temper? Oh, I'm sure you wouldn't. Please say you forgive me, Mrs. Lynn. It's hilarious, honestly, because it says there was no doubting her sincerity, but it came to, and it really touched Mrs. Lynde. But Marilla was like, Anne is enjoying this. She's totally enjoying this. And she actually wants to scold her, but she's like, I can't scold her for apologizing really well. And she did. She apologized so well that Mrs. Lynde was like, all right, I think I'm going to like her. And so she totally turns things around.
Yeah, she's like, and, this isn't really a punishment, but
I know.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yep. Anne and Marilla, they leave. There's good feelings with Mrs. Lynde. Mrs. Lynde even says to her, there was a girl that I went to school with. She had bright red hair just like you. And as she got older, it turned into a beautiful auburn. And Anne was like, I will always consider you a benefactor. Because you've given me hope. And so Anne and Marilla are walking home, and Anne suddenly came close to Marilla and slipped her hand into the older woman's hard palm. And this was really sweet and kind of a softening moment for Marilla.
I love that part when it says something warm and pleasant welled up in Marilla's heart at touch of the thin little hand in her own. A throb of maternity she had missed, perhaps.
Yeah.
Like, this could be something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I like how she has to ruin it, though, because then she says, if you'll be a good girl, you'll always be happy, Anne, and you should never find it hard to say your prayers.
Going back to the prayers thing.
You can't just let it be a moment. She had to like slip in a lesson.
Yes. But she's going to learn and grow and evolve. And so is Anne. And it's really, it's brilliant writing, and it's a wonderful thing to witness. So,
yeah. Oh, so good. And the other thing I loved is when she says on their way home, she says, how can I be vain when I know I'm homely? I love pretty things, and I hate to look in the glass and see something that isn't pretty. It makes me feel so sorrowful, just as I feel when I look at any ugly thing. I pity it because it isn't beautiful. She's so hung up on the fact that she thinks she's ugly, you know? Yeah. Poor little girl.
Yeah.
And it's true. Like, I was, when I read that, I was like, she does appreciate beautiful things. And so it must be really hard for her to like look in the mirror and think everything around me is beautiful. And I don't think I am.
Yeah, really, though.
I swear this, every page of this book has just great quotes.
Yes.
Next week, we'll do 11 through 20. That will be.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, there's so much good stuff in here. It's just, it's exciting. There's so much to look forward to. So many fun things to talk about and read about. So,
I know. And it's one of my favorite stories ever, ever, ever. I don't remember reading this as a kid, actually. I think I've only read it as an adult. But like I said, I've watched the movie hundreds of times when I was a child. I haven't watched the third one. There's like Anne of Green Gables, and there's Anne of Avonlea. And then there's a third one where she's grown and has a child. And I've been meaning to check that out from the library because I haven't watched that one yet. And I think I've read, have you read the whole series?
No, I have not.
I think I've read the first three books.
Okay.
But someday I would like to read the whole series. That's a goal of mine. Okay, I have a question. Have I shared with you the book, The Last Love Note? I'm like
I
concerned.
don't think so. I
Okay.
don't think so.
I think that's the one I have not told you about. So this week I'm listening to Persuasion because we are doing it later
Yes.
in the month or
Yeah.
in the year, but my book club is doing it in February. And so
Oh, fun.
I told you earlier I'm taking this psychology class and I learned, which I knew this, but that it's good to go into something that you're reading or listening to looking for stuff
Yes.
because it then you see stuff. I don't know how to explain it.
And you're
Anyway.
probably a lot more engaged that way.
Yes. And so I tried to start Persuasion like three times and I was like, I listened for like 10 minutes and I'm like, I have no clue what's going on. So I've been reading the Sparks notes online, the like each chapter. So I'll read the
Okay.
summary of chapter one and then listen to it. Makes all the difference. Like 100%. If anybody's ever having a book that they like reading a book that you can't, I would suggest that. Like read a summary of what you're going to read first and then listen to it. Or read it, and then you'll totally see what you read in the summary. You're like, oh yeah, that. And then I was always doing it backwards, where I would try to listen to it first and then read the summary before I moved on. But this works much better. So, anyways.
Yeah, that's an excellent suggestion for all classics, and I would say especially for Shakespeare. So definitely read Spark Notes, read story versions, everything that you can get your hands on, and then dive into the play
Yeah, it'll make
itself,
way
the
more
original.
sense. And I even texted my book club and I was like, you guys, if you're having trouble, because a few of them have trouble with Jane Austen, I'm like, you need to do this and then listen to it or read it
Yeah.
because it'll totally make more sense. So the
That's
book
awesome.
that I want to talk about is called The Last Love Note. And it's about this lady who is like married to her high school sweetheart. Basically, one day her and her husband are like driving, they get in a car accident, they go to the hospital. They're fine, but they go to the hospital, and her husband's like, things are a little weird. Things have been weird for me. They do some brain imaging or whatever, and he has early onset Alzheimer's or dementia. He's like 38.
Oh,
And
geez.
so within 2 years, he's died. And she was pregnant when they got in that car accident, and then she lost the baby like the same day that she found out he had Alzheimer's, which is extremely unfortunate. So she just has, it's just her and her little boy. And she has this boss that I don't know, has always been very kind to her. And so, like, the whole book is just basically him trying to help her through her grief. And then you can imagine what the last love note was from her husband. But part of it was like he had all these post-it notes all over the house that would remind him of what things were. And till then, he couldn't remember even. The notes didn't even help him. And so, like, it's 2 years after his death, and she can't like get rid of the post-it notes because it's got his writing all over. And like one day she found a post-it note that said, the boy's name is Charlie. I'm like, oh my gosh. It
Oh.
was like the most heartbreaking, but it's weird because it's not heartbreaking. The book was like so positive. Like, I never cried. I was never like totally overcome with sadness about, I don't know. It was very well written in that way. So I really liked it. I mean, it's probably not one of my favorite books of the year, but it was good
Was
and
really good.
interesting and made you
Cool.
think like, well, I'm glad nobody in my life has early onset dementia. Like,
Seriously.
awful.
What's the name of the author on that
Oh
one?
yeah, I forgot. I think it's Emma Gray. It's The Last Love Note by Emma Gray. And I found it. Somebody again was doing like a book author book chat with her.
Unfortunately, I do not have anything to share because I talked about the Book of Five Rings last week. So I haven't been able to start anything new. But I've got this one book on, well, I've got a couple books on hold that I'm really excited about. And it said there wasn't much of a wait on them. So hopefully I'll be able to share one of them next week. But yeah, so I'm kind of the worst. I am reading, but
Well, you
not
have a
telling
new
the
job
class.
that you're doing a lot of work
That
for, so.
is great. I am reading, well, I can show you. This doesn't help anybody who's listening, but I am reading this baby right here. It's 700 pages.
What is it?
It's the Certified Personal Trainer Manual. Foundations and Applications for a Certified Personal Trainer.
Do you
it's
have to read the
huge.
whole thing?
Yep.
Oh
So
my gosh.
I guess that is what I'm reading.
We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery, chapters 11 through 20. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.